go. Yes, wonderful. Thank you for that typical Johan kind of introduction. Yeah, it's a real pleasure to be here today. And I thought I'd kick off with something a little bit off the wall. I don't know how many of you know Norm MacDonald passed away this week. How many of you know who Norm MacDonald is? There's a few hands here. So just in honor of Norm MacDonald, I thought I would start off with a Norm MacDonald story. So you two probably know the kind of thing that's coming. So let me just share this little story with you. It's from Norm MacDonald with slight alterations from me. So it's about a guy called John who grew up in the States. He grew up in Manhattan, very privileged upbringing, and went to one of those fancy Manhattan schools that's like a feeder school for the Ivy League universities, did really well, got a 4.0 GPA, went to Harvard Law School, came top of his class, graduated magna cum laude, went to Princeton, did a PhD in constitutional law. I mean, he was just on this stellar trajectory, next stop, Supreme Court kind of thing. And then suddenly, nothing. He just drops out. He just disappears off the radar completely. And 10 years after his school graduation date, they obviously have a school graduation reunion, and he's not there. And one of his friends, Matt, decides, I've got to track John down. So he tries to find out where is John living. And he finds out he's working in an aquarium in Los Angeles. So he flies to LA and finds John, and he's there, and he spends his entire life looking after this young orphan dolphin. That's what he's doing with his life, and he cleans him, and he feeds him, and he plays with him, and everything, and it's all very cute, but he can't help thinking, is this really John fulfilling all of this potential that he had? So over lunch afterwards, he's just chatting to John, and he just thinks, no, I'm going to go for it. And he says, John, look, I've seen what you're doing here. It's lovely. It's very impressive. But do you really feel you're fulfilling your potential? And John says, yeah, I get that all the time. I get that from my parents. I get that from Uncle Freddie. Look, and what I always say to them is, here, I really feel I'm serving a youthful porpoise. Anyway, sorry, if you like that, you could check out Norm MacDonald on the internet. If you didn't, don't, because it just gets worse from there on in. Particularly his moth joke. Just don't go near his moth joke if you don't like that kind of a story. Okay, so my segue from that is, Sam Harris knows everyone, so I'm sure he knows Norm MacDonald. That's the closest I can get for a segue into a talk about Sam Harris. Okay, so I've titled this something that might surprise you, why I agree with Sam Harris about religion. And we'll get on to that. But first of all, for those of you who know nothing about Sam, just a little introduction. There he is, handsome dude. He graduated from Stanford and did a PhD from UCLA with a rather interesting break in his studies to do 10 years, I think it was, of meditation in Nepal, which is not normally what you do in your sort of academic career. Very interesting guy, really eclectic range of interests. Neuroscience, obviously, philosophy, consciousness, religion, spirituality, all sorts of interesting things. Highly successful author. His most famous book, I think, is The End of Faith, which he started composing on the day after September the 11th, inspired by the attack on the World Trade Center. He's also known for his pods, Making Sense and Waking Up. My family will tell you, his Making Sense pod is eagerly awaited by the Calcott family. It's one of my favorite podcasts. And he is really one of the most prominent sort of public intellectuals in operating in the world, really. So why do I like Sam Harris so much? He's an amazing communicator. How many of you heard Sam Harris's pods? Yeah. I just love his pods. You know, I once read a critique of Sam. It was actually by one of his enemies, I think writing in Slate or something like this. And he grudgingly admitted something about Sam. He said, most of us like to imagine we can think in complete sentences. Sam thinks in complete paragraphs. And I think that kind of sums up his intellectual prowess very well. And you listen to him talking, and he comes out with a really coherent discussion that you think, gosh, he conceived all of this, all of the next 5 minutes of the discussion in one go. It's amazing. And he comes up with these lovely little pithy descriptions of things that you think, why didn't I think of that? And can I write that down and use it later? It's just really impressive. Sorry, that's not right. And he's also incredibly intellectually courageous. What I mean by that is he will tackle subjects other people are scared to tackle, particularly in our present era of cancel culture. You know, he has extensively written and broadcast on Islamic fundamentalism, and he pulls no punches, which he now receives death threats and has to up his security because of that. He's unafraid to challenge certain issues which sacred cows in American politics on the left, such as issues around BLM. He really is very intellectually courageous, which I really admire. And he refuses personally to be tribally siloed. I don't know how familiar we all are with the kind of insane tribalism that's developing in the States. You know, you are on the left or you're on the right, and really there is no middle space. And if you don't conform fully to one ideology or the other, you're in trouble. And Sam refuses. He refuses to do that. He says, look, I'm going to call it out as I see it. And sometimes I'll be seen as the enemy of the right, and sometimes I'll be seen as the enemy of the left. And I really admire that as well. And he also emphasizes that issues are not always black and white. There's nuance and gray. And I think that's really important, in particularly in the present environment in the States. Something else that he does is he tries to steel man people's arguments. That's the opposite of straw manning people's arguments. This is so common, again, in all forms of discourse in the States, particularly, but everywhere, is people will present the worst possible take on their opposition's arguments, won't they? And he says, this is not a good idea. This just leads to increased friction and tribalism. What we must do is steel man each other's arguments. We must present even arguments we disagree with, we must present in the best possible light that we can. And that's something he tries to do, which I think is very admirable. And he's aware of cognitive biases from maybe his neuroscience background. He's aware that we try confirmation bias and all these kind of things, and he tries to handle that as well. And he deals with the big questions, you know, he deals with interesting questions. He gets interesting people on. I don't think I've ever heard a dud podcast from him. Always his guests are absolutely fascinating. And I would say he's the best podcast host bar none. In fact, you can kind of tell that because in actual fact, when you listen to one of his pods, the most interesting bits are actually when he's talking rather than his guest. So but he does a very, very good job of giving his guests the space they need to speak as well. And he looks like Ben Stiller. Now, he denies this. If you talk to Sam, I don't look, but come on, he looks like Ben Stiller. So what I'd like to do is engage with Sam on two of his favorite topics, really. Religion, as I've mentioned already, and free will, which from a neuroscience background he tackles. And I'm going to start with the second of those. What does Sam think about free will? So he's very straight. He's very courageous. He tells it how it is. This is his discussion of free will. Free will is an illusion. Our wills are simply not of our own making. Thoughts and intentions emerge from background causes of which we are unaware and over which we exert no conscious control. We do not have the freedom we think we have. If you read his little pamphlet on free will, you'll see he comes very much from a physicalist point of view. And he says, look, this just follows. We are the sum total of the causes and the physical forces of the universe and the state of the universe in the previous instant to now, and none of that do we have control over. So free will really is an illusion. We may think we have it, but we don't. The feeling of freedom actually just simply arises from our ignorance. It arises from the moment-to-moment ignorance of these prior causes of our actions. I think, again, he's quite brave in doing this. There's a lot of people who would hold to a physicalist worldview, such as one of his fellow horsemen of New Atheism, Daniel Dennett, I'm sure you're all familiar with. He goes with compatibilism, so he doesn't want to throw free will out of the boat. So he completely agrees with physicalism, but he says we've got free will, just not how we think we've got free will. And he comes up with this complicated argument that because it's our brain that does this, we do have free will even though it's not really free will. And again, I think Sam calls him out on that. And I think he does it in a very nice way. If you read his book, again, he doesn't straw man Daniel. He quotes him and he shows him the quote and says, is this a good representation of your argument? Yes, it is. Okay, I'm going to put it in the book, which I think is good. Again, and this is his comment on this idea that somehow we can still extricate an idea of free will from a purely deterministic physicalist world. And this is what he says. How can we be free as conscious agents if everything we consciously intend is caused by events in our brain that we do not intend and of which we are entirely unaware? We can't. To say that my brain decided to think or act in a particular way, whether consciously or not, and that is the basis for my freedom, is to ignore the very source of our belief in free will, the feeling of conscious agency. So he says it's not enough to say it's your brain that's doing it, therefore you kind of have free will. And I think he's right on that. That follows from his premises. And from a physicist's perspective, I have to just put this up, equation you're probably all familiar with, and you can see physicists get so excited about this, they tattoo it on their anatomy. This is Schrödinger's equation, which is completely consistent with Sam's physicalist approach. It says the physical universe is completely deterministic. It's governed by this wave equation, and if you know the initial state of the universe and you know the laws that govern it, it's all just deterministic from there. To quote the queen bee of science communication, Sabine Hossenfelder, what she says is, in a nutshell, the whole story of the universe in every single detail was determined already at the Big Bang. We're just watching it play out. The deterministic laws of nature apply to you and your brain because you're made of particles, physicalism, and what happens to you is a consequence of what happens to those particles. Now, some of you may be thinking, but what about quantum indeterminism? That's not really a get-out, as she explains. There's no escape that way. Random events in quantum mechanics are not influenced by you, regardless of what exactly you mean by you, because they're not influenced by anything. That's the whole point of saying they're fundamentally random. Nothing determines their outcome. There's no will in this. Not yours, not anyone else's. So I think Sam is very consistent with the science on the basis of a physicalist worldview. What are the consequences of the lack of free will? And he gets to grips with these, but here I think he doesn't begin to do such a good job. So what about purpose and meaning? I'm sure all of you are probably already thinking, if all my actions are entirely determined at the point of the Big Bang, where does meaning and purpose come into my life? And he tries to grapple with this. Here's one quote from him. Getting behind our conscious thoughts and feelings, so understanding we don't have free will, can allow us to steer a more intelligent course through our lives while knowing, of course, that we are ultimately being steered. I have to say, I see a kind of contradiction there. It allows us to steer a more intelligent course, but actually we're not doing the steering. So I think this is where I'd part company from Sam. He's trying to resurrect some concepts of purpose and meaning in our lives, but really, the absence of free will, completely deterministic universe, doesn't give you that. And on moral responsibility, obviously, you've probably also been thinking, if all our actions are determined, what about the punishment of criminals? You know, that horrendous mass murderer, there was no conscious choice involved in that. He was destined to do that billions of years ago. What's the sense in punishing someone like that? And Sam bites the bullet on that one. And he says, no, there is no sense in punishing. Our only responsibility should be assessing risk, protecting innocent people, and maybe deterring crime. So, for example, if there's some horrendous series of murders carried out, you know, someone kidnaps young children and slaughters them in some horrendous way, if at the trial of this person, their lawyer is able to demonstrate conclusively that this was a total aberration in this person's life, they're over it, there's absolute certainty that they will not commit these crimes again, on a purely deterministic physicalist approach like this, you should now release that person. Because there's no sense in punishing them, they are now not a risk, they can just be released into society. And I think that sort of somehow
grates inside with concepts like justice, and I don't think Sam really gets to grips with those as well. And from my perspective, the problems of purpose and meaning and moral responsibility justice actually derive from the assumptions that Sam feeds into this model, the assumptions of physicalism, that we are nothing more than atoms and molecules. And I'd like to talk to him about that and challenge him on that. But I'd like to move on now to discussing Sam on religion. So I don't know how many of you have read The End of Faith. It was written, obviously, as I said, he started it the day after September the 11th. I think when you read it, you'll realize it is written with a certain amount of fervor, and he doesn't pull his punches. Sam is brutal about religion. This is actually one of his sort of more moderate comments, along the idea that religion is responsible for terrible suffering. A glance at history or the pages of any newspaper reveals that the ideas that divide one group of human beings from another, only to unite them in slaughter, generally have their roots in religion. It just gets more emphatic from there onwards, really. I want to engage with that idea. And the second concept that, if you really were to summarize The End of Faith, the second thing he says is that religious beliefs are completely without evidence. It goes without saying these belief systems are uncontaminated by evidence. And I want to also engage with that a little bit. Okay, so I titled this talk, Why I Agree with Sam About Religion. And let me just explain a little bit more about what I mean by that. I've got this little diagram here in which I try to illustrate religion in action, how I think we can see religion works in practice around the world. So basically, religion is about people, I believe, trying to get to heaven. Simple as that. And the route is by keeping the rules. Now, depending on the religion, the rules will differ, of course, and heaven might be called paradise or whatever, but that's fundamentally what it's about. We want to get to heaven. How are we going to do it? We're going to do it by keeping the rules. Thou shalt not, all that kind of stuff. Okay, that sounds good, but there's a problem. It's human fallibility. We can't keep them. We just can't keep the rules. And that leads to feeling bad, repenting of the bad things we did that we didn't mean to do, a new resolve to try harder, but then we crash into human fallibility again. And I call this the religious cycle. It just goes round and round because of human fallibility. We're fundamentally unable to live up to the rules. I think in Judaism, there's 613 rules you have to keep. We just can't do it. We had, famously at our self-catering cottages, we had a group, a lovely group of Orthodox Jews came along. And it was fascinating just running into them and seeing the extent of their rule-based life, because obviously they were here on a Sabbath, and they were Orthodox Jews, and they kept the Sabbath fully, and it was quite interesting. So keeping the Sabbath meant they were not allowed to turn on light switches. So all the lights that needed to be turned on, we had to come and turn on the light switches for them. And they also couldn't turn on a kettle, but they still would like to have tea. So, but they were allowed to nudge the handle on an urn. That wasn't breaching the Sabbath. So we set up this urn, and they just accidentally nudged it or something. But things got really silly when it came to the toilet, because tearing loo paper is not allowed on the Sabbath. And literally, I kid you not, the head of the group came up to me and said, would you be able to provide someone on the Sabbath to tear our loo paper for us? And it didn't turn out this way, but I just had this image, you know, of me in the loo with the person sort of passing around the back the torn loo paper. But no, we pre-tore the loo paper and they used that. But these rules, how do you keep 613 rules? You can't. So what happens is, well, this is very well summarized. You might recognize this quote. I have the desire to do what is good, but I cannot carry it out. For I do not do the good I want to do, but the evil I don't want to do, this I keep on doing. That's also, of course, a quote from Paul from Romans chapter 7. He's describing this religious cycle in action, the frustration of being unable to keep all the rules. So what are the effects of this? Well, the effects on us are frustration. We just can't do it. Guilt. We failed. We can't keep the rules. But also a sense of self-righteousness. At least we're trying to keep the rules. unlike those unbelievers who are not trying. And so this religious cycle also has impacts on how we see other people. The unbelievers, disdain because they're not trying, condemnation, and often terribly a delegitimization of them as proper people because they're not even trying to keep the rules. And this can have very bad consequences. The anger that our frustration creates and the anger we feel towards other people can create very, very bad things. So, for me, I think that accurately describes religion in action. But some of you may be thinking, some of that's actually familiar from situations outside religion. And it's interesting, I think you can see similar cycles in other areas of human ideology. So, for example, let's look at communism in action. Now, communism has kind of abandoned the intrinsic value of the individual. So it's not the individual that's really at stake, it's the state, and it's not heaven, it's utopia here on earth, and it's not so much the rules as the five-year plan that we're working with. But you actually see a similar cycle in many ways. You know, we've got the plan. This is how we're going to achieve utopia on earth. Ah, there's a few hiccups. It's not quite as easy as we thought. In fact, we run into failure. I mean, one of the classic examples, I'm sure you're familiar with this, is the Great Leap Forward in the late 50s and early 60s in China. Mao Zedong had established, you know, complete rule, this personality cult. He was the great leader. And he decided China needed to leapfrog into a new scientifically dominated economy with efficient agriculture and an industrialized society. And he had a plan. And for example, on the agriculture side, he identified the four enemies of the state, which were rats, mosquitoes, flies, and sparrows. Sparrows ate a lot of grain, you see, so they were enemy of the state. And the entire nation was mobilized to deal with these enemies in quite an extraordinary way that, of course, couldn't be possible outside an authoritarian state. Literally, primary schools were shut down while children killed sparrows. And they did this rather intriguingly. What they discovered is if you could bang pots together, that would keep the sparrows flying, and quite quickly they would die of exhaustion and fall to the ground. And this was done across China, and millions upon millions of sparrows, basically the entire sparrow population of China was eliminated. And one of the only refuges for sparrows were the foreign embassies in Beijing, because that was foreign soil. And they must have been jolly clever, these sparrows, because literally, particularly the Polish embassy was flooded by desperate sparrows. I don't know, the word got around, you've got to get to the Polish embassy. And so the Chinese, they asked the Polish, could they come in and finish off the evil enemies of the state that they were harboring? And the Polish said, no, you can't. And so they literally stood around the embassy for days on end, banging together pots and things and causing the sparrows to continue to fly. And in the end, the Polish embassy staff were literally shoveling up dead sparrows by the bucket load. It was extraordinary. Okay, the enemy of the state was eliminated. All good? Well, not quite, because as well as eating a little bit of grain, sparrows ate locusts. And when the locusts were gone, there was nothing to eat the locusts. And immediately they had a massive locust plague. And combined with other elements of the Great Leap Forward, which are not quite as great as Mao had imagined, we now had the world's greatest ever famine. Estimates are up to 60 million people starved to death, like more than the total population of South Africa. Tens of millions more suffered agonizing hunger, starvation, stunted growth, malnutrition, etc., which is still impacting China today in terms of the damage done to people who are infants at that age. So the same kind of circle of failure, in one sense, can be seen in communism. Not quite as easy as we thought. Failure, rethink, new plan, try harder, not quite as easy as we thought. You could call that the communist cycle. And I think it has remarkably similar outputs as the religious cycle. So for the dear leader, he's got to have absolute power to enforce the plan. But of course, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And along with it comes a sense of paranoia. You see this in Mao, you saw this in Stalin, you saw this in Enver Hoxha, you see it in Pol Pot. There's an extraordinary paranoia that comes with the dictatorship of absolute power. And just like in the religious cycle, the unbelievers are denigrated, you actually see the same kind of thing. There are counter-revolutionaries who must be struggled against. Disdain, condemnation, and delegitimization of them follows. And you get very similar awful effects, as you see with the Cultural Revolution, very bad things. So, to summarize, I think religion is terrible. But is it just religion that's terrible? Or are we looking at a more fundamental flaw in humanity in general? And just to dig into that, one case that Sam talks about and describes in horrific detail, I promise I won't give you any of the horrific detail because it's very horrific, but if you want to, you can read it in The End of Faith. He talks about the work of the Inquisition, and it is really very terrible. And basically it went like this. When the Inquisition arrived in an area, suspects were rounded up, tortured horrendously, until they, of course, eventually confessed, but particularly they were required to implicate other suspects. After they'd done all of that, they would be executed. But then, of course, the other suspects would be rounded up, and they would be subjected to the same thing. And it so it went on and on. Each suspect would implicate further suspects who, under torture, would implicate further suspects. Absolutely horrendous. But some of you may be recognizing familiarities with that and what's happened in other areas of human existence. For example, my daughter's recently spent some time in Cambodia, living with the Cambodians in the slums, working, rescuing girls who'd been trafficked into the sex industry, sold into the sex industry by their parents, which is quite horrendous. But anyway, and the stories of what the Khmer Rouge had done in Cambodia are still fresh in people's memories, because it was the late 70s this happened. You know, I was a schoolboy. And the similarities between what they did and the Inquisition are absolutely remarkable. So in the infamous S21 prison in Phnom Penh, something like 15,000 people went through S21, and 15, they think, emerged alive at the other end. And they did exactly what the Inquisition did. Suspects were brought in, subject to utterly indescribable tortures, until they implicated 10 other people. Then they would be executed. Then the 10 other people would be brought in. They would be tortured. They would implicate. And it just rolled on and on in a very, very similar way to the Inquisition. And it wasn't, of course, just the Khmer Rouge. You can see exactly the same thing Mao did out of paranoia to his own Communist Party. Again, horrendous tortures required implications of other people. Stalin, the same. MVRG, you can actually find a long, long list of people who've done exactly the same kind of thing. So is this just a terrible case of the Inquisition, or is it actually a terrible case of humanity? Even if we look at maybe one of the high points of humanity and humanism, the Enlightenment, even that is not as golden as we might imagine. For example, one of the philosophical founders of the Enlightenment is Rousseau. His book, The Social Contract, really was very influential in the French Revolution. And the key concept there was this concept of the general will, that there was something more important than our individual wills. It was the general will which governed the welfare of the state and hence everyone in the state, and this should be prioritized over the individual will. And this really found a resonance with the French revolutionaries. So in 1794, Rousseau was entombed with great fanfare in the Pantheon in Paris. And in the same year, the terror was raging in Paris. And Robespierre, at the center of it, had this quote at the same time as Rousseau was being entombed there. "Terror is nothing more than speedy, severe, and inflexible justice. It is thus an emanation of virtue." You wouldn't think that, but it is, apparently. "It is less a principle in itself than a consequence of the general principle of democracy applied to the most pressing needs of the state." So he even found justification in the philosophy of Rousseau for this incredible reign of terror. And of course, it was just as horrible in many ways as some of the stuff that went on in Cambodia, the torture, the killings, etc., because of these enemies of the state. So I think I would summarize my differences with Sam here, and I totally agree with him. Religion is a bad, bad thing. But humans in general have a pretty bad track record when it comes to some of these things. And I'd like to just fill this in a bit more by talking about religion's most famous victim. I'm talking, of course, about Jesus Christ. Because Jesus Christ was put to death by the religious authorities at the time. Reading the Gospels, you'll see that very clearly, but just to give you a few quotes here. Then the chief priests, the religious authorities, and the elders of the people assembled in the palace of the high priest, the top religious authority, whose name was Caiaphas, and they plotted to arrest Jesus in some sly way and kill him. And this is, of course, what they did. The chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowd to ask for Barabbas and have Jesus executed. They all answered, "Crucify him." So what's going on here? Why did the religious leaders hate Jesus so much? Well, he broke the rules. As we said, religion is all about keeping the rules, and Jesus had no time for rules as rules. You know, there was this very fierce enforcement of the Sabbath. You must do no work on the Sabbath. We've seen from my Orthodox friends. And Jesus said, you've got it wrong. The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. The Sabbath is actually there to provide a necessary day of rest. You're messing it all up with your rule-making. You're making it a burden to place on people's shoulders. That is not what the Sabbath is about. So he constantly broke the rules that they imposed viciously on the population. And a lot of what they did, of course, like all religious leaders, was about control. It was about their power. It was about controlling the population through these rules. And Jesus was uncontrollable. And he threatened their power because he was so popular. The people flocked to him because they really responded to his message, which was not about these rules they couldn't keep. And he fraternized with sinners. The people they had delegitimized, Christ legitimized and wanted to be known as being amongst, and they really hated that. And he called them out. "Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You shut the kingdom of heaven in men's faces. You yourselves do not enter, nor will you let those enter who are trying to." If you look at Christ, we'll come on to this, but he has amazingly gracious statements towards everybody. There's no condemnation except for the religious leaders. He really calls them out, and you could see how that could desperately annoy them. Okay, so I just want to look at a little comparison between religion and Jesus, because I think Sam conflates the two, and I think for someone who's very committed to nuance and is very good at nuance, I think he's missing a trick here, because they really, really are quite different. So religion, as we've said, is all about rules, and Jesus was not about rules. He was about relationship. Very different. You will not find Jesus saying, "Do this, do this, do this, do this." Instead, he says, "Follow me. Know me. I am the way, the truth, and the life. Come to me, all you who are weary and heavily burdened, and I'll give you rest." He even says, "I'm the vine, and you're the branches." Actually, salvation comes through being intimately connected with me, not through keeping a set of rules. So he was fundamentally different to religion in the way he dealt with how salvation is achieved. It's not by rules. We can't keep the rules. It's actually through relationship with him. And religion was all about despotism. Leadership was crushing, and leadership elevated the leader. Those who were led were there to serve the leader. And Jesus turned that completely upside down. I'm sure you know the story. In the Jewish culture at the time, the worst job you could get as a servant, the one that was always given to the most junior servant, was washing the guests' feet after they'd arrived on a long, sweaty day. I think you can imagine how icky that would be. And what does Jesus do? They've arrived on a long journey, he puts a towel around his waist, and he comes and washes his disciples' feet, which shocked them completely. But he did it to illustrate that his type of leadership was servant leadership. He said, "Look, you call me master and teacher, and you're right, but look what I'm doing. In my kingdom, the greatest must be the least, and those who want to lead must serve." So he totally upended the way religion works and lords it over its people who try and follow it. And religion is all about condemnation. It's all about the do's and don'ts, and those who break it are very, very heavily condemned. So, you may remember the story of the woman caught in adultery who's brought to Jesus, and the religious authorities say, "The law says we must stone her." And Jesus says, "Okay, let him who's without sin cast the first stone." And one by one, they drift away. He was totally not about condemnation, Jesus. He was about grace. Another story I just love is actually the story of Zacchaeus, because remember, in the Jewish world at the time, they were under the crushing heel of the Romans, and they hated the Romans, because the Romans weren't nice. But they even more hated the Jews who collaborated with the Romans. They could understand the Romans had to kind of do what they were doing, but the Jews who collaborated with the Romans, they were the real scumbags. And the worst of the worst were the tax collectors, because they were extracting the money Rome needed from their very own people. So Zacchaeus was an utter outcast because he was a tax collector, and he wants to see Jesus. He's a small guy, climbs up in a sycamore tree. Jesus comes along, and he sees Zacchaeus, and he does something absolutely extraordinary. He says, "Zacchaeus, come down. I'm coming to your house for a meal." Now, in Middle Eastern culture, having a meal with someone is the ultimate statement of acceptance, much more so than even in Western culture. We don't really understand what that meant. That meant, I see you, I accept you, you are not condemned by me in any way. I wouldn't have done that. I mean, think about it. If you were a Jew, there's a damn tax collector. I'm not going to have a meal with him. Jesus doesn't see it that way. And of course, he gets results. It'd be lovely to know what that conversation between Jesus and Zacchaeus was. It's not recorded. All we know is Zacchaeus came out and said, "I'm a new man. I'm giving half of all my possessions to the poor, and anyone I cheated, I'll give them four times back what I cheated them out of." A changed man through grace, not through condemnation. And finally, religion is all about vengeance, an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, or maybe a couple of teeth for one. And you see it working out in Afghanistan now before our eyes. You know, anyone who's deemed to have collaborated with the great enemy, they're being eliminated. In ISIS's war in Syria, you know, a horrendous incident I remember being shocked by. Saudi pilots were bombing ISIS targets, and one of their planes got into trouble, I think, and the pilot ejected and was captured. And ISIS said, "Okay, you've been dropping bombs, explosion, fire, we'll burn you alive," which they did, because that's vengeance. That's what vengeance kind of requires. But that wasn't Jesus. Jesus preached forgiveness, but even more so than that, he demonstrated forgiveness in the most incredible way. I mean, if any of you have seen The Passion of Christ, it's horrific how vividly it portrays the sufferings of Christ's flogging and crucifixion. This is unimaginable agony, which I dearly hope none of us will ever go through anything like that. We can't imagine the physical suffering involved. And what does Jesus do on the cross? He says, "Father, forgive them. They do not know what they're doing." He practiced absolutely what he preached. He preached, you know, forgive those who persecute you, do good to those, to your enemies, and he actually did it in an extraordinary way. So I think Jesus and religion are not the same thing. They actually could not be more different. And I would take issue with Sam that he's conflating these two in possibly an unhelpful way. Okay, Sam's second point about religion, that it's completely devoid of evidence. He's got lots of quotes on that. If you actually search end of faith on the word evidence, you get 78 references. He's very obsessed with evidence and the complete lack of evidence that religion has, and how people don't look for evidence in religion. It goes without, here's a few quotes, but they are just a few of the many I could quote. "It goes without saying these belief systems are uncontaminated by evidence. Every religion preaches the truth of propositions for which it has no evidence. Religious faith is distinguished both by the extravagance of its claims and the paucity of its evidence. Religious faith presents so uncompromising a misuse of the power of our minds that it forms a perverse cultural singularity, a vanishing point beyond which our rational discourse becomes impossible. Believing strongly without evidence, they have kicked themselves loose of the world," talking about religious people. "The faith I'm calling into question is an act of knowledge that has a low degree of evidence." Now, the first thing I would say is I think, again, Sam is conflating Christ and religion, Jesus and religion, and I think that's not appropriate. But what I would like to do in that context is just look at what evidence the followers of Jesus claim is the evidence for following Jesus, particularly for his deity, for him being the Son of God. I'm sure you're all familiar with this, but you know, Romans chapter 1, Jesus Christ was declared to be the Son of God by his resurrection from the dead. and again in Corinthians, if Christ has not been raised, our preaching is useless, and so is your faith. We are to be pitied more than all men, but Christ has indeed been raised from the dead. And in the Bible, in the early church, in the modern church, the resurrection of Christ from the dead is used as the key piece of evidence for following Jesus. So, why doesn't Sam even mention that? Because he doesn't. In the end of faith, or in Letter to Christian Nation, he just doesn't mention this issue at all, which I find perplexing. He very much, in these two books, he is presenting an argumentative confrontation with religion, and specifically in the latter, in Letter to a Christian Nation, with Christianity, with people who want to follow Jesus. And he does bring up certain evidences that he thinks people use, but he never mentions this one, which is strange because it is the primary piece of evidence that Christians use. I can only think of three reasons why that might be. The first would be that Sam is unaware that the followers of Jesus use the resurrection as the key piece of evidence. I don't think that sounds very likely. Sam's a smart guy. Sam has been interacting with Christians for decades. He must be completely aware that Christians do bring this up. So I think that number one is unlikely. So if he's not unaware, then perhaps he is aware that Christians do use this. And then really you've only got two options again. The first is he has very good arguments against the evidence for the resurrection, but just didn't include them in either of his books dealing with the subject. Doesn't sound very likely, does it? If he had the knockdown arguments, I'm sure Sam would have unleashed them upon his foes, because it's that kind of book. If you've read either of them, they are really aggressive, and he likes to nail all religious people, but Christians as well. So that leaves us with a third possibility. He doesn't have good arguments against the evidence for the resurrection. And one reason I think that's the most likely explanation is his friend Richard Dawkins wrote another famous book called The God's Illusion, and he has a chapter addressing evidences for God, and again, he's completely silent on the resurrection. He goes through all sorts of wacky and weird arguments that people have employed for the existence of God, does not mention the evidence of the resurrection. It's kind of weird. Okay, so in conclusion, Sam is an amazing, talented, admirable, and courageous person. I really do admire him a lot. He's great. And I think he's really consistent, and he really does bravely follow the consequences of his physicalist worldview to its obvious natural conclusion, which a lot of people duck that. But maybe he doesn't give the non-physicalist alternative much of an airing. He presents it as if physicalism is an obvious conclusion of all rational people, follows from science. I'm speaking at Dialogue tomorrow evening, and I'll be presenting some of the scientific reasons why we might, that basically push us in the direction of rejecting physicalism. And I think there are very good arguments there. He doesn't mention them. I think that's an omission. I think he's dead right about religion, but I think he's a bit easy on the rest of humanity and humanism, because as I've shown, they can actually do just as bad things as religion. In fact, the 20th century, you could say, is an age of outrages that were not religious in nature. They were non-religious in nature, specifically atheist. Sam conflates Jesus and religion. I think that's strange, because they were so diametrically opposite. And Jesus is the most famous victim of the religious cycle. Here's a question. Why does Sam ignore the question of the resurrection, the evidence for it? Only he can illuminate us on that, really. And Sam is the person alive today I would most like to meet and chat to him about these issues. Thank you very much. Thank you for listening to me on Sam. I hope that's been illuminating and informative.